And now, broadcasting live on Star Worldwide Networks, it's time for Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. If you suffer from addiction to opiate pain relievers, heroin, alcohol, or other substances, we're here to give you hope and help you overcome your addiction. Now, here's your host, Dr. Nelson.
Opening montage, chapter one, titled Grief Like a Torn Dress Should Be Left at Home. The camera descends through the delicious mists of a pot of simmering chicken soup at 4639 North 10th Street, the house where I grew up. There I am, having been born into an idyllic Jewish family unit, smack dab in the middle of the 20th century, with a working father, a beautiful housewifey mother, and a strong, handsome three-year-old brother. I started life in the North Philadelphia neighborhood called Logan, in a row house with mortgages payments my parents considered affordable. When Mom and Dad brought home their bouncing baby boy from St. Joseph's Hospital, my mother pressed her tender ear to my tiny chest and heard a heartbeat that was anything but regular. The next day, Mom called the delivery doctor and told her she heard something strange when she put her ear to my chest. The doctor had already detected a loud murmur associated with a bicuspid aortic valve disorder. The doctor didn't want to tell my parents right away about my defective heart and ruin the family's first night home with their beautiful new baby boy. There was an operation available to repair said defect, but in the 1950s, one out of every 10 kids who underwent the knife to repair the errant valve never made it home to watch Howdy Doody ever again. In those days, there was no heart-lung machine. The surgeon would have only 3.5 minutes to replace the little piece of shit valve in my heart. Mom was not about to play beat the clock with a life-threatening experimental surgery, but she was willing to bet that operating room technology would advance faster than my valve's health would retreat. Mom was certainly right on that estimation. 3 weeks later, after I took center stage, my daddy dropped dead of a heart attack on his way home from working the night shift at the United States Post Office. He was 34 years old. Suddenly, there was a gaping hole in our lives. No husband, no father, no breadwinner. And so my life began. Back to you, Doctor.
Okay. Thank you. That was an excerpt from a book called High, Confessions of a Cannabis Addict. And the author that we're going to speak to today is Leonard Lee Bushell. Leonard Lee Bushell is a California certified substance abuse counselor with years of experience working with people struggling with addiction. He attended Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. And Mr. Bushell is the founder of Writers in Treatment, whose primary purpose is to promote treatment as the best first step solution for addiction, alcoholism, and other self-destructive behaviors. Leonard is the director of REAL, Recovery Film Festival and Symposium, which he founded in 2008. And he is the editor publisher of the weekly Addiction Recovery e-bulletin. And he also produces the annual Experience, Strength, and Hope Awards in Los Angeles. And he just celebrated his 27 years clean and sober. And so I know you wrote the book in 2021. Are we going to need to change that that number to 28 years now?
You very well may.
All right.
Yes. And that milestone did pass, that came and went on August 4th.
All right. Congratulations. So if you're wondering, you are listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery, and this is the 168th episode, and I am your host, Dr. William Nelson, along with my producer, Robin Cote. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Leonard, I don't even know where to start. I asked my wife, Stephanie, who arranges a podcast for me, I said, who's our yesterday, and she said, oh, I got some guy from California, and I started to read your bio, and then I went online and got your book, and I sent Leonard text earlier. I said, man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to stop reading the book to do the podcast because I was so drawn in. And man, oh man, anybody out there listening, whether you are working on your own recovery, you have a loved one that's challenged with their addictive process or substance, or whether or not you just like good literature, this is a book that anybody could enjoy, and on very many levels. And I want to talk to Leonard about his history and his story, but man, oh man, I think one of the comments somewhere I think I remember is the thing that comes to mind is this should be put into a movie, and I think Barry Levinson should be the director because it reminds me of Diner. And I don't know what it is, just the way you tell the story and your descriptive ability and even that. It's really funny, Leonard. I was going to suggest to you when you chose an excerpt, I was going to choose that very excerpt to tell you. I think you should read that one that you included. So thanks very much for that.
You're welcome. I spent about 45 minutes trying to find another place to read for you this morning. But it seems though the book is built on previous occasions and episodes and anecdotes. That was the first one that you don't need any previous knowledge of what had happened to me or what I did in my life. In other words, it builds. It builds, and I wanted to say, you know, to your listeners that, you know, I have to admit, I really only got high once for 26 years. And if I can get clean and sober, anybody can. But I also want to say that if I can write a memoir / autobiography, anybody can. I wrote this by hand, in pencil, and then I had a friend type it up every day or every few days, depending on how much work I got done in a given day. And it was thanks to the COVID pandemic that I was able to actually finish the book. Because in L.A. we had quite a severe lockdown. Restaurants were closed. In other words, you're locked down. And I thought, if I don't finish this book now, I'm never going to finish it. So I took that break because I had a very busy schedule for the last so many years. And there was just never enough time to really sit and, you know, finish it. And I did. And I'm incredibly thrilled and happy and proud with the way it came out. You know, it's 254 pages that, as you said, I think it's a real page turner. It's very engrossing and engaging, and hopefully people, I didn't write it to get people to like me. I wrote it to get people to know me, and I think I really accomplished that. No holds bar, no editing out the embarrassing things, or diminishing my accomplishments. You know, being clean and sober is probably one. You know, it's funny, the PIN number for all my bank accounts is my sober day, which I might not reveal now because there's probably some hackers in your audience. I sense you very interesting and intelligent people. But that's sort of like the day I was reborn, never anticipating it or even expecting it. And I didn't go to the rehab to get clean and sober. I simply went because I was having a nervous breakdown from a serious breakup with a woman, and we were using a lot of ecstasy. We were using ecstasy to make up after every time we had an argument. And I don't know whether we were having arguments every day just to take ecstasy or whether we really just were having arguments. But it really depletes my system, and I thought I couldn't stop shaking, and I went to the rehab really just to rest. I had no idea. Luckily, the God of Fool, which I possessed at the time, I did not know anything about recovery, anything about sobriety. I'd never been to an AA meeting, never thought of quitting everything. I just couldn't stop shaking, and I ran into a friend on the street, miraculously, who had my only person on the planet who had been to a rehab. And she ran into me and said, "You don't look so good." I asked her if that rehab she went to had an 800 number, because I wasn't going to pay for a toll call. She said yes, gave it to me. And 3 weeks later, there I was driving to Palm Springs to check in to a rehab. And when I got up to the front desk, I said, "Hi, you know, I'm here to check in." And the woman said, "Check in? It's not a hotel. It's a hospital. You're here to be admitted." Semantics right away. I got into the nurse's office. I said, "They're not going to brainwash me here. You know, not that my brain couldn't have used a little rinse." And she said, "Oh, no, no." And then like 2 minutes later, someone's thumping a big book into my hand. You know, it's like a thump. And I thought, "Oh, what is this?" It felt like a copy of Mein Kampf or the Bible. You know, and I looked at it and it said, you know, the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thought, "Oh, okay. Like they said they weren't going to brainwash me, but here they are with this incredible handbook of living," which I didn't know that at the time. And my intention, as I said, was just to stop doing ecstasy at that time. And I was also addicted to blackouts. I loved vodka and I loved tequila, and I like drinking enough to where between the hours of like 2 and 6 in the morning, I didn't remember what happened, except for the Polaroid pictures that we had. And I would remember not remembering that. You know, I never thought growing up I would ever know what a blackout was, because I didn't like the taste of alcohol. I didn't like the effects of alcohol. I liked cannabis. I liked hashish. And eventually I liked marijuana. But it was hashish that was actually my very first love. Black hash, red hash, kief from Morocco, Nepalese temple balls from Nepal. It was quite and Philadelphia seemed to be like where a lot of the hashish came into the States. And it was a time when I was in my first year of college that my friend and I realized we couldn't find any hash. There were no dealers in Philly who had any hash. Everyone we knew in New York didn't have any hash. And we thought, we have to go get some. And we looked on the map because we were smoking red Lebanese hash at the time, and we noticed that Lebanon was right above Israel. And I was 20 at the time, and we thought, well, we're Jewish. We should go. We should go to Israel and get some hash. And we did. And our families thought we were going there to discover our roots. You know, our friends thought we were going there to make money, but actually we were just going to score. You know, the expression "going to any length" is very popular in AA as a prescription for getting and staying sober. Well, we went to any lengths. We flew the longest nonstop flight in the world at the time. It was 12 and a half hours from New York to Tel Aviv. We went, and 3 weeks later, we were on a plane back to Kennedy with the girdles we had bought the night before, stuffed with hashish underneath our pants, because we couldn't live without it. And I know most people say, "Well, it's just marijuana." Well, when you smoke every day and you depend on it for every positive emotion and feeling and thought in your head, I could not live without it. And we risked our freedom to go get our stash. And it was quite an adventure on many levels. And I can't tell you what a relief it is to go through customs in New York City with a pant filled up with a underwear full of hashish and have them say, "Go ahead, next, next, next." Because at that moment, I could have ended up in jail for 10 or 15 years. But I didn't, you know. And ironically, or stupid.
So this is around 1970 or so?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And I went back 6 months later because it was exciting. It was exciting, and this time I went back to, bring back more. And I don't consider myself to have been a smuggler. I did it twice, and I don't think twice is a career. I did start dealing drugs in my last year in high school. In fact, one of the only reasons I went to 12th grade in high school was because I was selling pot, and I was also selling football pools because I was addicted to gambling at a young age. So that was sort of my first addiction, so to speak. My first addiction was sugar. Couldn't go a day without a couple Coca-Colas, television, totally addictive. But I didn't realize years later, one day I walked into my apartment, I was alone, I turned on the TV, and as the crackling of the screen, forming its picture, as that started to happen, I realized that my brain started to turn off. And I could see the relationship between distraction and mindfulness or consciousness. Same thing about gambling. When you're gambling, you're not thinking about homework or your job or your wife or your kids or your finances because you're so in the moment. I've often said that if you have $100 on a horse to win a race, when that gate opens, for the 2.5 minutes it takes for them to circle the track, you're not thinking of any existential problems. You're not thinking of death. You're not thinking of sex. You're not thinking of disease. You're not thinking of other people either. You're not thinking of compassion or love. You're thinking about that horse being the first one to hit the finish line to make you a winner. And I realized, having been a compulsive gambler at the time, that it's not winning that people are addicted to. It's the emotions of winning or losing. Even losing gives you a heightened emotion of, rather than just being a mediocre, flatlining, average, middle path kind of day or person. Even the depression that comes from gambling can be negatively seductive. Because at least you're feeling your feelings. Even if they're bad, you have feelings that you're feeling.
You started that at the Cooper's little store as a 12-year-old boy, and your advantage was that none of your classmates understood the point spread. So I thought
that helped. Yeah.
At any rate, you're very astute. And, that comes across in your writing and your perspective. But, yeah, so tell us a little bit about that life that you lived. And your dad died, a couple weeks into your life. And then these men who were of all walks and character were kind of like your surrogate role model and, maybe a composite of all those there. So, tell us about how that was as a child.
Well, one of my saving graces is that I lived in the same house for 20 years growing up. The house that my mother and father bought at that time, we lived in for 20 years. My mother immediately had to go to work to make the mortgage, and I was considered, I think they call it a latchkey kid. Uh-huh. She was never home when I got back from school, so I was free to get into trouble. I was a good boy who did bad things. I liked shooting rifles. My father had left a rifle behind, just a simple .22 single shot, but I liked shooting things. Windows, sparrows, to this day, I apologize. Every sparrow I see on the street, I say a little prayer because, they were my easiest targets, my easiest prey growing up. But and I liked to set fires. I was a bit of a firebug. Thank God no one ever got hurt and no serious property ever burned down. But I was alone. And my brother had been sent away to boarding school. So I knew I really had to sort of behave. Not that he was sent away because he was doing anything wrong, but he was bad. But my mother couldn't handle two very rambunctious children. And there was a school in Philadelphia called Girard College that was completely free. And when you graduated there, you had a 2-year college education already. So it was a very good school. So my brother got sent away. So I was alone, lonely child. And I'd like to do things that were a rush.
How old were you when he went away? And you weren't able to go because of your asthma and your medical condition. Is that right?
And my heart condition. They would not.
Oh, right, your heart.
Yeah. Other one. Yes.
Got it.
It was about 6. I was about
okay.
5 or 6 when he got sent away.
Wow. So as a 5 or 6-year-old, you were kind of like left to your own device, you know, after from school gets out at 2 until your mom would get home at 7 or 8.
You remember the good old days when you were 8 years old. If you knew how to cross the street alone, you could cross the street alone.
Wow.
And literally 2 blocks away was the candy store called Cooper's Corner, owned by a man named Ben Cooper. You know, and I did end up naming my son Ben. I don't know if it was after Ben Cooper or Benjamin Franklin, you know, our famous Philadelphian. Or I didn't
right.
know I named him Benjamin because he's on the $100 bill. Or I don't know whether I named him Benjamin because my mother used to have an affair with a married man at the Benjamin Franklin Hotel. And so it's all mixed up.
Yeah.
It's
well,
all related.
Any number of those. Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, it was more interesting than there was nothing good on television in the afternoon. So I would go to the candy store and get into interesting conversations with guys. We'd play a lot of street ball, you know, stick ball, half ball, handball, a lot of ball playing, and a lot of them were gambling. And so that's where I realized I can make a bet on a Phillies game. You know, my hometown favorites. And it was 1964 when they were 10 games ahead and about to crush to win the National League pennant. And for 10 days in a row, they lost and the St. Louis Cardinals won and they got beat in the end. And I was so despondent as a kid because I was 14. You know, you went at 14 back in the old days, not anymore, but, you know, your hometown team. You lived and died on every victory and every loss. And I kept a notebook. I cut out the box scores every day. And they lost. And I think a lot of people in Philly who were my age at that time possibly still have not gotten over their depression. From they called it the Fold, PHOLDF, Fold for Phillies.
Yeah.
Very traumatic. And so the candy store was, you know, street baseball, not baseball. We couldn't use baseballs because we'd break too many windows. But we used rubber balls with a stick, and if we didn't have a stick, someone would just walk through the back alleyway and find somebody who left their mop out and, you know, screw off the mop and take the stick, and we'd play stickball. And I think, you know, I just got done listening to a book by Mel Brooks, very funny guy, still alive, very old, very funny, and he said the greatest time in his life was growing up in Brooklyn. The streets of Brooklyn as a kid was as close to heaven as he said he'll ever get. But then when he started school, they had something called homework. And he was really offended. He says, "What do you mean? I actually now have to do work? I'm just a kid. I just want to play."
Where you were in Philly, Logan, is that South Philly or where is that?
It's actually
North Logan, North Philly.
It's North Philly. It's a couple miles north of Temple University.
Yeah, but in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood.
75%. The thing is that people didn't move. Had the same neighbors. That's what I was trying to say earlier. The same neighbors for 20 years. Yeah. Nobody got divorced. Nobody moved. And it was very stable. You know, the schools I went to, the elementary school, the middle school, the high school, it was the same kids who went from one school to another because they were all from the neighborhood. Yeah. And I know a lot of people now I meet, and they went to like five different schools growing up. And I'm thinking, God, it must have been so traumatic. Because, you know, the first day of school, who's going to be there? Who's going to be tougher? Who's going to be prettier? So it was a very stable situation, even though the fact of not having a father made me very, you know, in school every year you have to fill out, you know, your name, your address, your parents, and what they did for a living. And in elementary school, I learned how to spell the word deceased, because that was the occupation of my father.
Wow.
He was deceased. And in the schoolyard, when guys were hanging out, talking about their weekends, what they were going to do with their fathers, or what they had just done with their fathers, or what their fathers did for a living, I would sort of slink away from the conversation because I was embarrassed that I didn't have a father. You know, it wasn't until I was in the rehab that I read the book by John Bradshaw on shame that I realized I was experiencing shame as a young boy for not having had a father.
Yeah.
I didn't know what that word was at that age, but I just knew it made me feel uncomfortable.
Right.
And so I would slink away from the conversations until it turned back to sports or school or other things. And I didn't know that until I took the 28 days and went to a rehab and got to not get high and not drink for a full month. And the thing that blew my mind was that I could do it. I didn't know it was literally on a quantum level possible to go 28 days without drugging or drinking.
Could I back up just a bit?
Yeah.
When was the first time? Well, I was going to say, when is the first time you got high? But I think I know the answer. The first time you got high is from the gambling and even the pinball machine that you were so good at. So that was an altered state of consciousness. And then that maybe set your brain up for having the effects of, what was it, pot or alcohol? And how old were you when you first got high?
I was 17 when I had my first inhale of marijuana. It was secondhand smoke. I was literally coming home from the racetrack, and the guys in the front seat, you know, said, hey, you might want to turn your window down, because I was young. I was 17. They were a little older. They smoked a joint. I didn't inhale anything. I mean, I was in the car, but I remember walking into my mother's house, my house where I lived, thinking, my head feels a little strange. There's a little pressure, and it's not unpleasant. And then a couple weeks later, we were up in New York, my whole family, and we went to visit my genius cousin Bob in Greenwich Village, and my mother went out to do some sightseeing, and he said, hey, try this. And I smoked some pot, and I thought, oh, my God, my life just went from black and white to color. Suddenly, I could see again, or I could see things that I had failed to notice, as I'm sure it is the experience of many marijuana smokers. You know, how much better does music sound when you're high?
Mm-hmm.
It does. You know, and to this day, the only time I miss being high is when I'm in a jazz club. And I went to a lot of jazz clubs my whole life. Jazz was a big part of my existence. And it's only, and in the last 28 years of being without weed, it's the only times I think, it might be nice to be high now. But no other time do I think that.
Yeah.
Except that. That's like a euphoric recall situation. So I smoked it, and the next night my mother said, hey, let's go see the Rockettes. And I said, you know, which, as you know, is like a bunch of scantily clad women kicking their legs up and spreading their legs in front of the audience. And I said to my mother, I said, no, that's okay. I'd rather go back and visit Cousin Bob. I had my first taste and I wanted another one.
Yeah.
And I did, and it never stopped. It never stopped. I never didn't have... And then some years later, because I had this heart condition, I was afraid of white powders. You know, right. When other people were doing methamphetamines, they used to call it speed or crank. I was always afraid of that. The idea sounded good, like, oh, wow, you can, you know, be up. But I was afraid for my heart. And I was at my doctor one afternoon, and I said, oh, by the way, there's this stuff, cocaine going around. I said, would that be dangerous for me because of my heart attack, my heart condition? He said, no, just don't shoot it because you could get an infection from the needle, and that would kill you. You know, so for my whole life, whenever I go to a dentist, I have to be what they call, and I'm sure everybody out there with any kind of heart condition understands the expression, pre-medicated. Yeah. I have to pre-medicate before I go to a dentist with, you know, the 2,000 milligrams of amoxicillin. Yeah. Because during dental work, when they break your... when you can, it's how Bobby Darin died. Bobby Darin, the great rock and roll singer. Well, it wasn't actually rock and roll. But anyway... you can get an infection. So for my whole life, going to the dentist has always been a little traumatic because I know it could kill me. But So anyway, the doctor said, don't use needles because you could get an infection. So I went right from the doctor's office, right 5 blocks away to my friend Eric Levine's apartment, and he answered the door. I said, hi. I said, do you have any Coke? He said, yeah, of course I do. I said, let me try some. And I remember he put out the lines and he starts chopping it with the razor. And just the sound of the razor going through the crystals of the cocaine sounded like Mozart or John Coltrane or John Cage. It was just some experience before I even had it in my nostrils. The whole ritual was just magical. And very attractive and very, very alluring. And then I put a little in my nose and, you know, it was a nice sensation. It was a nice sensation. It sort of clarified the marijuana high, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And I did that every day for 13 years.
Wow.
And I never ran out. Because I could never bear the idea of waking up in the morning and not having any. So I always made sure I had some for the next day. And since I was a Coke dealer, it wasn't difficult to always have a stash. Yeah. And I used to go...
Well, you were, if anything, very resourceful. You know, a 20-year-old hopping on a plane to get hashish and then figuring out what you needed to do in order to maintain your lifestyle. Did you ever get arrested or did you ever get in trouble with the police? Other than I remember you got arrested for hanging out on the corner for loitering or whatever.
Yeah.
But other than that.
The night before high school, my brother and I got arrested at the corner for corner lounging, a very ancient law, corner lounging. It was on the Philadelphia books for years. Anyway, that's besides the point. Yes, but the first night before my high school orientation, I was in jail in my local precinct behind bars. It was sobering. It was frightening, but I also felt like it was incredibly unjust. My brother and I there was no crime involved. But that being said, a couple years later, on a beautiful summer afternoon, I'm there with my mother, as we often did. We're watching television, eating Breyers vanilla fudge ice cream, and suddenly a cop kicks in the front door, which was easy because it was a screen door. It was summertime. It was a screen door, a flimsy wooden screen door. And then suddenly there's three cops in my house with guns drawn. And they were there because someone had dimed on me. Someone had said I was dealing marijuana, which I was.
Oh, man.
And I was still living at home with my mother. I was in junior college at the time. And the cops started walking upstairs, and she said, you can't go upstairs. And they said, oh, yes, we can. We're going to search your bedroom. And she said, you definitely can't search my bedroom. And she got in front of them, so they arrested her, too, for interfering with the operations of
interfering with the illegal search.
Yes.
Without a warrant, yeah.
Yes. And then they put us in the paddy wagon, and we got taken downtown. I don't think she'd ever been arrested before that. I got fingerprinted. I'm not sure if she did. And, you know, needless to say, it was one of the, you know, many amends I had to make to my mother when I ended up getting clean and sober. And they say you have to go apologize to people that you hurt before, and I did. But I also remember telling her on the ride home in the taxi, because we never had a car growing up, so I got very used to public transportation. We never had a car. I learned how to use subways and trains and buses at a very early age. So we're coming back from the precinct in a cab, and I say, you know, Ma, this is just like Germany. One day this marijuana is going to be legal because it's not nearly as bad as alcohol.
Yeah.
And that
took a few years.
It took a few years.
Yeah.
It took a few years, but thank God, I think it's one of the great social improvements in this country. You know, gay marriage and legalized marijuana is like two of the, you know, it makes me feel like I'm actually in a country that is not completely insane.
Yeah.
At least
Just recently, right before the pandemic, I went to the first psychedelic assisted psychotherapy training course for doctors and therapists. And I still was fascinated because one case study they showed with cannabis and another one they showed with your other drug that you're using, MDMA or ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they found with, the Gulf War vets and the people that were suffering from PTSD, totally lost. They did three heroic doses, spread out 1 month apart, and then had three integration sessions, and they had an 80-something% cure rate, not improvement of symptoms, but no longer had the diagnosis code of PTSD. And so those sorts of substances went from, you know, Nixon's war on drugs and basically a class schedule one, no medical benefit, extremely dangerous, highly addictive, to now it's the thing that they're trying to figure out how to roll out to help all these people that haven't been able to get clean and sober, because it allows them the flood of serotonin, allows them to educate or kind of revisit those traumatic experiences under the influence of those medicines, and they're able to process the trauma with licensed therapists and then come back sober and integrate the information learned. And to me, it's wonderful, and we're still figuring out how to use that and also how to roll it out. So I'm with you with the marijuana and these other things. We're not doing well. Our addiction work is not doing well, but that to me is possibly can transform the treatment and to get much better results if done correctly.
Yes, I agree. Not having a medical background, I do have a lot of real life experiences with people, and I do publish a newsletter. I want to give a little plug to the Addiction Recovery e-bulletin. We're now in our 10th year. We publish every Tuesday morning, completely all new stories, you know, curated from or aggregated from the BBC and the New York Times and all the top-notch sources of news. So I have to say in the last year there is probably a story on the psychedelic revolution that has been happening, because it's gotten...
Yeah.
You know, laboratories are allowed to study it now. Before they wouldn't. They
right.
get arrested or shut down. So it's
sure.
been cleared for scientific research in a number of states, and a number of universities are seeing what they can do with it.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody like Richard Nixon called Timothy Leary, the most dangerous man in America.
Right.
I don't think they would say that anymore about you.
I don't think so either. Yeah,
William Nelson is not the most dangerous man in America. He could be one of the more helpful men in America. If people listen to this show, what did you say? You had 169 episodes so far?
Yeah, 168, yeah.
68, okay. Next, see, I would have liked to have been on the 169th. It would have had some special meaning to me. But be it as it may, I'm proud and delighted to be with you here today. I know we don't have all morning to talk. I wish we did. If you ever get to
you said that I hope I can, you know, share useful information for that amount of time, and I'm sure that you and I could talk either on the podcast or just face to face for much longer than that. And so
you're not allergic to Los Angeles, are you?
No, not at all.
Okay, don't forget to look me up when you get here.
I will. Where do you live in L.A.?
I live in what they call Studio City, which is next to North Hollywood, and it's near Encino. It's a very residential, calm little neighborhood.
Yeah, I got a brother in Walnut, and then my best friend who just got back from a two-week vacation in Greece to help him celebrate his wedding. He got married in Greece, and we just got back Wednesday, and he lives in Agora Hills.
Not far.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll make it out there, and we'll have to hook up. I'd love to get a chance to meet you in person. You know,
go ahead. No,
you go. I was going to say, the reading your bio and that we talked about earlier, and I was reading the list of influencers or people that came in and out of your life. And, you know, speaking of Timothy Leary, his fellow Harvard cohort who both lost their job, their position at Harvard for LSD, Richard Ramdas.
Yeah.
And then, you know, how did you run into him and the beat, you know, was that from Naropa? And how did you find your way up there? Or maybe help us figure out, was that before or after you got sober?
Anyway, before. Before, but I maintained a lot of those relationships, and a lot of them did come after. And Richard Alpert was Dr. Richard Alpert, the Timothy Leary's partner at Harvard, who then became Ram Dass, ended up being my neighbor in my town in Northern California, in a little town called San Anselmo, and I'd see him at the diner many mornings. And he never quit. He stuck to his spiritual guns until the very end, until he ended up having a stroke and ended up living in Maui and never stopped writing. He wrote books on aging as he aged, and he was, I think that book, Be Here Now, will be considered one of the groundbreaking books of the so-called New Age spiritual revolution that started to take place back in the 1960s.
Yeah, I read, I don't know if it was in your book, I just read someone to that very point, the power, you know, and then Eckhart Tolle was probably a part, obviously influenced by Ram Dass with that book. But they said if you have anxiety, you're operating in the future. If you're depressed, you're operating in the past, and to be truly healthy and be vital and really experiencing all of the juice that life has for all of us, you're in the present. You're here and now. You're an existential Paul Tillich, you know, kind of experience.
So Ram Dass is just a guy I sort of got to know. And,
cool.
Admire greatly. And I spent a couple summers living and working in Boulder, Colorado, where the Naropa University is located. It was founded by Trungyam Rinpoche, who wrote another classic of the 70s called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And he was a Tibetan master, and he founded a college there with Allen Ginsberg that is still there.
Yeah.
And great courses, meditation, poetry, literature, what have you, martial arts, a great place if people are looking to sort of switch it up a little. Check out Naropa University in Boulder. And they also started the publishing company called Shambhala Press. Which
I've read a bunch of books from that.
Right. So it's
yeah.
It's all still happening. It's all happening now more than ever, I think. And I think the world, as they say, is going to hell in a handbasket. But that's judging hell negatively.
Yeah.
I'm sure Eckhart Tolle would say judging is sort of like not being, I don't know, judging. How can you not judge? We're all human.
Yeah.
You got to like things. You got to love certain people. You got to dislike other people. I don't like the word hate. Because, you know, if you hate somebody, you're a conduit for hate.
Right.
I don't want to hate anybody because I don't want hate in my system. So I say I detest.
Or you can withdraw from the influence of those people and hang around and be engaged at a higher level of consciousness with those that you can learn from. Not that you need to agree with everybody, but I think one of the challenges I have, and I think it's our culture we have, is, you know, I never learn much from people that I agree with or already know. So, and that's kind of a comfort zone. But mm-hmm. being challenged by people with, you know, at least if they're coming from a positive spiritual vibration and kind of this positivity and operating from love rather than hate, I can certainly learn a lot from them, especially in regards to how I can be a better person and being pointed out like, wow, I didn't realize I was doing that. So.
So it's always be a doubly good person to make up for other people being shitheads.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us, we got about 12 minutes left. And for those out you listening, we're having a conversation with the author of High, Confessions of a Cannabis Addict. And Leonard, tell us if you could share your best advice. If you got an opportunity, not that you're going to change people's lives, because people are only going to change their life when they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
But let's assume there's a couple people out there that are ready. What would you like to share with them regarding your past, your history, where you are now, and someone who's ready to make a change, and even if they think they couldn't, how do they find their way sober?
I wish I had a pat answer for that.
So do I. But let's hear the real one, because the pat answer probably isn't going to help. Coming from your heart, that's what's going to help.
You know, but I worked for a number of years as a drug counselor, and I always said, people aren't going to get clean and sober because of what they hear me say. They're going to get clean and sober for what they hear, for what they hear themselves say to themselves. And I think there's a great lack of the concepts of courage. It takes courage to give up. People, you know, I read this study that kids from abusive homes. You know, at some point, we're offered a friendly foster home, but they didn't know it was friendly. They were told it was friendly. You could go to a foster home, or you could go back to your abusive household. And they would choose the abusive household because they felt more safe with the familiar. They felt, you know, as opposed to the unknown. The unknown is probably more frightening than pain and suffering. And when I on a very personal level. Thank God I had been exposed to Joseph Campbell for a number of years, who wrote, obviously, The Hero's Journey and a number of other great books. And the idea of, I used drugs for 26 years every single day. Like I said, I used cocaine for 13 years of my life every single day. And here I was, given the choice by being in the 28-day facility. And I highly recommend you find a small, safe facility if you're really in a life-threatening situation, and spend a month away from your substances, away from your family, away from your bad habits, and decide whether you want to live or die. Do you want to live a life of pain and suffering and mediocrity, or do you want to live a life that could turn out to be the most beautiful, wonderful experiences you've ever had, that far exceeds any high you ever had? Just be courageous. And I only learned that from, you know, hearing my therapist one day say it. I said, I'm going to have a colonoscopy and I'm really afraid. He said, be courageous. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. Courage.
Yeah.
It's like maybe a long lost art. I don't know. Do they use that word in high school? Do they say, oh, if you're, you know, having a difficulty, you want to persevere, go through. I don't really know the answer to your question. Just try and love yourself. What would you do? Treat yourself as your own best friend.
Yeah. I think that's a great answer, because, you know, and I'll have people come in and, you know, I luckily never became addicted to anything. I was a binge drinker and, you know, I had my own issues and, you know, smoked pot, but I somehow just realized pretty early on, man, if I keep doing that, I'm not going to have the life I want. So I don't even know, you know, my story, but basically I got into the treatment of addiction because my stepdaughter was a heroin addict and OD'd 5 times and she got Narcan shots and cardioconversion. And, you know, we thought she was definitely going to die. And she's now coming up on 9 years sober, got a little grandson out of the deal, and she's amazing and we're proud of her, but she's a miracle. And then from that experience, kind of learn on the job training. I didn't know much about addiction, but I learn every day from my patients in recovery. And it seems, I think the take home message, that if you don't mind me summarizing or kind of adding to your thought, I think is, if we're looking for easy answers from someone else who's been successful, you don't really understand the complexity of the problem, because it's work. And I tell people, you know, I do a naltrexone pellet insert, so people, it's like a Vivitrol shot, but it lasts for 4 to 6 months. And during that time, they can't use, and it takes away the cravings. And so the options are, you can get to work and create your sober life and right. do what you did, what you said, is be courageous and go into your levels of uncomfortable situation and really get to work at it. Or you could go and watch Oprah reruns actually would probably be better. I was going to say, usually I say Kardashians. Watch, what are the Kardashians going to wear and where they're going to get their nails done? I think Oprah would probably be more helpful, because she seems to be on the path to helping others.
At least she has a book club.
Yeah. Oprah. And has thoughtful people on there. So.
Yeah. Yes. No, I absolutely. Yeah. I don't understand why she has to be on the cover of every issue of her magazine. That's my
she's
only.
She's good at self-promoting.
She's done a lot. That just seemed, you know, it took vanity to a new level. I'll start a magazine and I'll be on the cover of O every month. I mean, she always looks good, but it's just. You know, speaking of book clubs, I don't know if you've mentioned, but my book is available right now on Amazon. You know, thank you for. Loading at the paperback is only $19. It's a good read. There's lots of photographs in the book. It's an easy read because my vocabulary is not college level, but it's advanced high school level. It's easy.
Depends on when you went to high school. Depends on when you went to high school. I was reading yours, and your ability to express yourself in like the way I was describing it, like a Barry Levinson screenplay, is like you were describing the situation. I was there. I was in Philly. I was in that little corner store with all the various characters, and I was so now I haven't finished it. Now I got to go back in there and see how it ends. But we kind of know the end of the story. It's not the end of the story because you're still here, but through your story of addiction and recovery. So I would highly recommend it. It's the book High, Confessions of a Cannabis Addict by Leonard Lee Bushell. And Leonard, can you give us any other contact info?
I have a website. It's leonardbushell.com, L-E-O-N-A-R-D, Bushell, B-U-S-C-H-E-L. The Addiction Recovery eBulletin.org is online, and it changes completely every week. And, you know, I explain how I became a news junkie, because growing up in Philadelphia, we'd get the Philadelphia Inquirer delivered in the morning, and around after lunch, I'd buy the Daily News. And then at 4 o'clock, there was the Bulletin. It was the good old days of journalism.
Yeah.
You know, and they competed, and they were wonderful. So I became a news junkie way back then. So I've turned that into making a living with my my online magazine, addictionrecoveryebulletin.org. I'm not hard to find. I was thrown off Facebook last month for no good reason whatsoever. Otherwise, I would tell you to go there. Actually, I do have a news personality page on the Facebook, Leonard Bushell. You'll find me. Hey, I'm not hard. I'm, as people used to say, a moving target is harder to hit. Well, I'm simple.
We got and tell us real briefly about the real film festival. I may want to get back with you because we don't have one in Phoenix. Maybe we could see if we could get one, because I think people would want.
We've
and
been
would
in
need
a number
that.
Of cities right now. We passed on New York this year. We have a week-long event. It's the longest recovery event in the country. It's in Los Angeles on October 21st to the 27th.
Oh, just coming up.
Yeah, it's Real is R-E-E-L. We started it so long ago when we had to literally rent reels of film. Back in 2008, realrecoveryfilmfestival.org.
Okay.
Recovery
so,
website. We got 90 films scheduled for 1 week.
Wow.
If you're
out in the area, make sure you stop by. And those of you maybe know some people out there, go out and check it out. I want to thank Leonard Bushell for being on the show today. Thank you so much. And thanks to Robin.
Thank you, William Nelson. Great time.
Yeah. This is Dr. William Nelson. Thanks to all your listeners for another episode of Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery.
Thanks for listening to Your Road to Personal Addiction Recovery with Dr. William Nelson. Listen live each week at this time or anytime 24/7 on demand at starworldwidenetworks.com.